Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Devendra Freitas.
On this week's show, we're going to explore how Digg went from becoming a king of social news to cashing out for $500,000. Then we discuss the transition of one of Google's top executives to becoming the new CEO of Yahoo and whether it's enough to save the flailing company. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And, first of all, we haven't had a show in a couple of weeks, and the main reason for that is because I just came back from San Diego Comic-Con 2012, which was...
Nice.
It's just a grueling... You know, Comic-Con is kind of like... I equate it to what I've heard about labor, that, you know...
I thought you were going to say Mecca.
It is Mecca. It's like, more Mecca than
Mecca.
Labor.
Yeah, okay. Labor. Okay.
It's grueling.
Because, no, Comic-Con is all about that long journey. And then you're just standing in a line. Yeah. You know, and maybe you'll touch this giant, like, square thingy.
Maybe
you'll touch Nathan Fillion, you know? And then the trip is worth it.
It's grueling. It's exhausting. You're in one place for hours and hours and hours waiting. And then... when it's all done, you know, like a year later passes and you've kind of forgotten, you have this amnesia about how terrible it was, and you want to go again. And
is that what labor's like? Yeah, you have amnesia about the pain.
It happens every year.
You end up pregnant again the next year. So that's kind of
wow.
I had talked about
women pregnancy. I think we don't know.
I had a great time at Comic-Con. I posted a ton of articles on Geeks of Doom, and we'll link to those in the show notes. And in fact, we'll link to the whole San Diego Comic-Con panel coverage at Geeks of Doom.
So I heard the Hall H situation this year was pretty terrible line-wise, and that's usually what it comes down to. How bad was the line waiting, Andy?
Well, let's put it this way. We had to get into line at 5 a.m.
Oh, man.
Just to ensure that we would get into the room.
What was the keynote in the Hall H?
Well, it's basically everything. It's basically, you know, you name it. Whatever big movie is coming out, from Django Unchained to the Marvel lineup to...
Game of Thrones was there this year, right?
Game of Thrones is in, yes.
Well, I know he was there last year. At least the Martin was there last year.
But it was in a much smaller room last year, and that was kind of a pain.
Yeah.
Why don't they just have it at a bigger convention center, or is there no bigger?
There really is none. Like, that's a whole other topic, but yeah.
Yeah, no, no.
They need to build their own.
We were, like, basically, by the time we got into line, the line had, at 5 o'clock, mind you, the line had already been out to the back of the convention out by the marina.
Yeesh.
Dude, it's an Apple product launch. You just got to be there the night before and sleep over.
No, it's pretty much the way it is. There were people lining up as soon as the last vestiges of the previous day's line had left and gone into Hall H. Then the new line started for the next day. That's pretty much how bad it is. And I don't anticipate it getting better or lighter.
That sucks.
Yeah, so it's just going to be a test of dedication on a yearly basis.
I was going to go next year. Now, not so sure.
I mean, you can still go. It's just, it depends on what you're trying to do.
Right.
Next, I wasn't able to go this year, but if I go again, I hope I don't have to, like, try to hit every panel and cover everything, because, you miss out on a lot of the fun when you're busy doing that, you know?
I want to see the comic books.
Well, then you shouldn't have any problem, except that the actual exhibition floor is actually crowded too, and it's hard to get through there as well.
It's the age of the geek. It's no longer just a niche thing. It's like, you know, all these pretenders show up trying to be cool,
and
in their outfits.
And Devendra's right in a way that it's like it's the largest area that I can think of that they can actually hold something like this. We were in Hall H, and I thought Hall H was bad, Ballroom 20 is where they were having the like the 10th
the Firefly
anniversary
thing, right?
Firefly reunion.
Oh my god.
That was the line for that day was insane. It was basically
Firefly has been closed for 10 years.
Yes, 10 years.
Dude,
but this
welcome.
Is a reunion of all of that all the cast and crew. So, we're talking about the line for that went from Ballroom 20 snaking all the way down to the marina, around the convention center, and back to the beginning of the Hall H line.
And basically, like, about 80% of the people in that line would have no shot of actually getting into that panel, too.
That's right.
So,
how was the Doctor Who panel? Did any of you go, to that?
Doctor Who, I did go to the Doctor Who panel. It was,
did you see them do the karaoke?
And no, they didn't do karaoke during the panel.
Oh, okay.
Must have been at a party, but they did talk about the upcoming season. We saw a couple of major clips from a couple of episodes coming up, and some retrospective of the previous season, and then a lot of Q&A from Karen Gillan, Arthur Darvill, and Matt Smith.
I gotta say, I don't really like Arthur Darvill. He doesn't
really
be there.
Oh,
he's like extra.
Hmm.
He's extra and whiny.
Anyway, moving on to another thing that I've been checking out this week. You know, Steam is like the video game distribution platform from Valve, who has created Portal and Half-Life and Team Fortress. So Steam is this major video game distribution network. And every year, I think actually maybe even twice a year, I think they do like one in the fall as well. They do this sale and it lasts like a week, and it's they basically close out like on a whole bunch of games, deep discounts on all these great games. And so I've been checking that out, and it gave me the opportunity to buy a couple of games that I've been thinking about, and had not wanted to plunk down the change for. One of them is called Dear Esther, and it's this kind of ethereal art piece on the Source engine, and it's kind of this dreamy, it's non-linear, and you're walking on this coastline in Scotland, and you're listening to this kind of moody narration, and as you're exploring, it's this nonlinear exploration. As you're exploring this environment, you get a kind of this sense of what's going on in the story. The story kind of trickles in to you on a very kind of elliptical way. And another game that I've checked out is called Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP. And it's funny, Super Brothers couldn't be more graphically different than Dear Esther, in that it's a very kind of flat 8-bit graphic, old school gaming representation. But in a way, it's very similar, because you're also wandering around this environment, and you get little messages that come to you every once in a while, and the story isn't told to you in like one big dump. You get it in bits and pieces. So these two video games that are so graphically dissimilar from each other have this common thread that reminded me of each other.
Yeah, Super Brothers is great. It's just so like fun and self-referential, and because it knows it's a game, it knows it's a very Zelda-esque game. So there are tons of great gaming references. The soundtrack is amazing too.
Mm-hmm.
Surprised you didn't play on your iPhone though, Andy. Like that's where iPhone and iPad was where it originally hit.
Yeah,
it's great on those.
Actually, I did get it for my iPad.
Okay.
Yeah. And another thing, one last thing that I was checking out this week is there's a new Kickstarter for a project called Ouya, and it's basically it's a video game console based that's an Android based video game console, and it's open source. And it's basically a small team of developers who are creating this console. It's kind of like, you know, the equivalent of like you've got the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and then out here comes this like independent or this Green Party. You know, this Ouya
Snitch will never win. Come on, Andy. Right. Well, who knows?
I hope he does.
That's
a
good. That's a really good question, because it's Ouya is coming out against these huge behemoths, Sony and Microsoft, and to an extent the Wii or the Wii U, and we have no idea. I mean, it's like the David to these Goliaths, and we're not sure how it's going to. How it's gonna fare, but it's got it's got some good people behind it, and I think like one of the advantages is that they've made it kind of developer friendly from the start. Like, they want people to develop for it, and they're intending that all of the games on the system will be free, at least to try, free to try. Many of them will be free, period. And then a lot of them will be free, like, free to try, and then you can buy into it when you like it. Yeah. I mean, this was bound to happen, right? Since it's Android-based. Yeah, no, we saw the mobile gaming revolution happen, and it's, like, very huge now. There aren't too many great Android games, but at least this is going to bridge the gap between mobile gaming and, you know, console gaming.
If you could pull this off, then you'll have a game that is easily portable to the handheld device, in addition to the game that's going to be on your TV. And I mean, it's what Steam has been doing a little bit here and there when it could, you know, Valve and Steam. But it's the evolution that we've all been waiting for, theoretically. We've seen hopefully this is the kind of thing that'll push Apple to make Apple TV available to have this kind of functionality, because I think that would be huge, but I don't know.
I wouldn't bet on that, but you know, Apple, I don't know, like, Apple has consistently shown it doesn't really care about games. It barely cares about the Apple TV, so I mean, I think first they have to get apps on that freaking thing first.
Yeah, exactly.
The UE is interesting because of the third-party development and, like, the stuff people could end up doing with this. Could power a ton of emulators, a ton of, like, pirated content, too. It's an interesting start. We actually had the guy who designed it, who designed, like, the Jawbone devices, like their Bluetooth headsets and the Jawbone app.
Yves Behar?
Yves Behar. So the day, like, this Kickstarter thing just really started picking up, Yves was at our mobile conference, and we were able to talk with him and get a sense of what he's up to. So we have Adventure Beat and Games Beat, the Games Beat section there. We have a couple good interviews with him. Just fascinating how this is also showing, like, the rise of crowdsourcing, too. Like, this is going to be a fully crowdsourced console.
Yep.
And that's kind of a big deal because, I mean, what are we looking forward to the next year from the big console makers? The Wii U? Nintendo doesn't know what that thing wants to be.
Right.
I'm a little worried that we're going to see, you know, like when you get on the Android store and you look up something like Angry Birds, at least back in the day when you used to? You would see all these, like, Angry Bird clones. Like, it's sort of like when you go to YouTube and you type in, like, something, you want to see some video, and you get all, like, the responses and crap like that. I'm a little worried the store is going to get cluttered because it's very expensive to have. It's very expensive to have people there to A, approve things, or B, just make sure that content is, like, not janky. That's expensive to, like, have full-time hires like that. So I'm a little worried about that, but I did buy into this. I bought into it because I believe in what they're trying to do, and I think that supporting this kind of thing is only going to drive other people to have to fall in line and get with it. So I'm excited about that, although I am a little worried about the fact that it's going to come out in March of 2013 with the hardware spec already there. March of 2013 seems, you know, with relative mobile technology, like, it's mobile technology, relatively speaking, that's a long way out, right? Like, there's going to be a lot of new chips and new other stuff that are going to be there. So I'm a little worried about that, but I think it's worth the shot, and it'll be at least a good collector's piece as a geek.
Dwayne, what are you playing with this week?
I got the Ouya. I also I was playing with the Nexus 7 this week. It's a pretty sweet device. Like, first of all, when you pull it out, everybody was like, "Wow, it looks like a small iPad," because it's got that it's got an iPhone 3GS look to it. The black with the silver wrap around, the chrome wrap around in it. The back is that classic sort of like Asian vinyl that you see in, like, you know, Samsung devices or Asus device. When I say Asian
almost
vinyl,
like carbon fiber. I don't know, it feels kind of cheap. Like, I've been testing one out too, really like it, but yeah, I'm not a fan of that.
The
type
back
of
is
weird
yeah
backing.
The back, I mean, it's more grippy, I'll give it that. Like, I had my iPad right there, it's more grippy. It doesn't, you know, the fingerprints are a little easier to notice than you would in the back of your brushed aluminum iPad. But there is really something about a device that powerful, that's 7 inches. I'm not sure if I'm holding it closer because it's smaller. I'm not sure that I'm doing that. I'm not sure that I can get like retina out of it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I do know that it's sharp. It came preloaded with like Transformers, Dark of the Moon, and a couple other things, like, you know, to demo it, to show you like what's capable on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was no stutter. There was no anything. And it's fast. It's very fast. It doesn't get so warm, or at least if it does, the insulation from the vinyl in the back doesn't let you know it gets so warm. And when I say it's fast, I mean, it's not that I see things snap in really quick ways, like I notice when I upgrade an iOS device. It's more like I just didn't notice any stutter. I didn't notice any issue.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very smooth.
Unlike any other Android device, right? Like every other Android phone and tablet I've used, at some point you're just waiting. Like you're waiting for Android to do something, to respond to you. Sometimes mm-hmm, processes mm-hmm. will crash. This thing is running Android Jelly Bean. It's like the newest, hottest version of Android right now. It's just fast. Like, it's a super fast OS. It's the most streamlined version of Android ever. And
I didn't
coupled
think
with
about
this
the OS when I was on it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You did, and that's a good thing. Like, you don't want to think about, oh, man, fucking Android. You know, you're right. Whatever the hell is going on there. Yeah, it just gets out of the way like a good piece of technology should.
Huh. It's a very good device. I think Google.
And it's worth $200. I mean, come on. $200?
It is worth, I think it's worth $300. I think if, like, if you took this back in the day to when the Kindle, the Nook came out, the Nook Color. It's just one of those things where $200 in 2010 or maybe early 2011 for the Nook Color was like, okay, it's going to be slow. It's meant to read things, but I can get some things done with it. With this device, if this device were out at the same time, it would have easily been twice what it is now for this functionality. It's
I mean,
a very
great
powerful
specs
device.
Because of that. Like, if for $200, you're getting, what, a quad-core processor,
quad
a gig of RAM.
It's good specs, but good the thing stuff. Is, and to your point earlier, I literally didn't think about the specs when I got it, because my tablet world and my mobile world right now, because it is so iOS heavy, I rarely think about the chips and so on. So I got on this thing and I wasn't even thinking about that. I just found that it was relatively intuitive. I was even using a little bit of the voice search on Google, and I just found that it was really streamlined. I didn't check to see if it could run any kind of Flash video, which I always do on other Android devices, because it's a novelty. Yeah. It's a novelty. It's a novelty.
Do you know the bit of controversy going on there, Dwayne?
Isn't it that like they're not going to support it on Jelly Bean?
Yeah, that's basically it. So when the initial version of Jelly Bean that was out, Flash would run fine. Mobile Flash would be fine on it. But 4.1. Afterwards, the update that came out for it just recently basically lists Flash Mobile on Google Play as something that's not supported by this device. Wow. And, you know, because Adobe's not going to develop it going forward, and I guess Google doesn't want people to, like, have issues with Flash and an unsupported OS. But it's kind of a pain, but whatever. Flash
is
never a selling point for anybody.
I think it was a selling point for some Android geeks, so I'm a little sad for them. Cause
they don't matter. They don't matter. Where were they buying Android tablets for the past 2 years?
No, you're right. They never supported the products. Even the Kindle Fire wasn't fully supported by a lot of Android geeks because it wasn't fast enough, because you do feel the clunkiness, the slowness of the device. This device is so far superior to the Kindle Fire. I mean, it is the equivalent of an iPhone 3G versus an iPhone 4S, I think.
Well, let me ask you a question now. Would this be a good buy for someone who already has an iPad?
I would say that if you're interested in having the difference is that an iPad is really a couch surfer or maybe a car surfer, right? Like, I brought my iPad on vacation. I've used it at parties, especially, you know, get some speakers, Bluetooth it out, whatever. But my iPad is not the kind of device I can like throw in a bag and go. It can go in my computer bag, you know, but it's not really a it's a bit big for just like super casual. I'm going to run out of my house and take my iPad. This is the size of the Kindle. And the Kindle, as we all know, can fit in like that little satchel you take out. It can fit in your hand without you thinking about it. And it's light. It's not a heavy device. Like in my hand with the iPad 2012 and the Nexus 7 hand in hand, the Nexus 7 is hella light.
Okay, now let me ask you another question, kind of a loaded question here. Say, for example, Apple comes out with a 7-inch device.
Of course they will. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the 7.85, which is basically the 8-inch, so it doesn't defy Steve Jobs' mandate from 2011, 18 months ago, right? Because they have to be really careful. They're not going to completely defy. I read the thing on John Gruber's blog yesterday, and he basically spent the equivalent of three pages saying why the smaller iPad is very important and they have to do it, but it actually doesn't defy Steve Jobs. It was the most apologist thing I've read in years.
Wait, John Gruber being an apologist for Apple? That's crazy.
He definitely twists around for that. Here's my theory on the smaller iPad is that we've been hearing about this design that Apple was working on something for some time now, like even way back when, like before the iPad 3 came out, and my source who was saying, oh yeah, it's going to be the iPad HD, turned out that was just the internal name. They were also saying, oh, we're also buying a ton of 7-inch screens right now. like Apple is the company that experiments and plans, so they're not going to sit there twiddling their thumbs while, you know, all these Android developers or Android manufacturers experiment with 7-inch tablets. And I feel like with the Nexus 7, it is so good. Like it threatens
their ability to grab this market if they don't move quickly.
Exactly. So likely they were developing a 7-inch iPad, and if a good competitor never showed up, because I don't think the Kindle Fire was ever a real threat to the iPad. That was something else entirely. But this is actually a threat to the iPad or to the tablet market for the iPad. So with this, we'll definitely see a 7-inch iPad or 7.8, who knows, a smaller iPad at some point soon. Because, yeah, holding this, you feel it. You cannot hold this, or you can't hold an iPad with one hand for too long. You can hold this like a little book. It's much more convenient.
Absolutely. And I also think about it this way, too. We were just talking about, like, the cost of the Nook color versus the cost of the Nexus. Think about it this way. There used to be an iPod Mini. The iPod Mini cost $250, right? This Nexus 7 costs $200. And, you know, we've lost value in money since the iPod Mini came out in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you an idea of what's capable with dollar amounts now. I really feel like if they wanted to drop a smaller iPad for as much as $250 to give it a $150 differentiator between the iPad 2 that's still available, they would have a device that people would flock to in a heartbeat. And given all I've read, how if they make it 7.5 inches, they can have a 1024x768 screen on it or whatever. Like, it won't be Retina, but it'll be good enough. And the fact is, if you look at the data, they've never actually started a device that is Retina. They kind of bring that up later once they get the device right. There's a lot of room for that device. So, Andy, to your point, if they released an iPad Mini, I would actually be into it. And the reason why I'd be into it is because, again, I've spent a lot of money in this ecosystem.
You're trapped.
I'm a little trapped.
That's how they get you.
It's how it is. When I walk into my house... you know, I can hit a button on one of my iPads and it's going to sync all the new data that's come down that day. I don't have to like do a lot of let's go to the app store and download the new apps or any of that stuff. It'll just sync it up and I'm still using it. I'm still like watching Netflix or like airplaying or whatever.
I take it no plans to get a Nexus Q then.
Oh my God. Right. I mean, Lydia said it best. This is a reason to keep the people. Someone said like the Lydia just said it was the Nexus Q is the reason why Google needs to keep like an eye on their engineers.
No, a leash. Put a leash on your engineers.
Put a leash on your engineers. Yeah,
please.
It's clearly. No one.
I was in San Francisco last week for our mobile conference thing, and I was just surrounded by a lot of these industry heads. I talked to a couple people who got a Nexus Q at Google I/O. And they kind of liked it, and I couldn't comprehend
what did they like
the
about
words
it?
They were saying. They like? They're like, it's going to be a great hacker device.
Gonna be
like, really at $300 that no one's ever going to buy. Right. They're like, yeah, it'll once Google discontinues it, it'll be a great hacker device. It's like that's the dumbest reasoning ever.
Okay, so maybe HP shouldn't have spent all that money on their tablet that became a hacker device. That really, I mean, like the tablet, the HP Slate or whatever. It was a hacker
the Slate. That was the
Windows touchpad. One.
The touchpad. Yeah.
The touchpad. It was a hacker device for all of 3 months until someone got Android on it, and then the development just fell apart. You know, like it's like that someone wrote a great blog post the other day, like buy the tech that you want today
yes.
at the best possible with everything that you want in it.
Yep,
if it's not going to be like it's barely going to get better, which means that if you know it's not going to be supported in the future, there's no reason to spend any money at all on it, right?
Right.
So it kind of makes you wonder about some of the Kickstarter stuff. But then like Pebble, right? You know that Pebble is banking a lot on this device and the popularity of this device. So you have an idea that there will be some sort of update to it, right? Like you're not too worried about that. Mm-hmm. Also, it's a smart watch, not a smartphone. But when you look at like the Nokia devices that have come out and how they won't be able to upgrade to Windows 8, and you look at some of the Android devices that will never have Jelly Bean,
right?
It's like really painful. It's really painful. Because you kind of think that the standard that's been set is that people deserve a little bit more. But the fact is, the data doesn't support that. You know, very few companies actually pull that off. Buy your Android stuff from Google directly. Don't think about anybody else. Don't ever touch anybody else. Buy an iOS device. That's kind of it.
So Dwayne, before we get into our headlines, tell us about you're also checking out AT&T's new shared data plans.
Oh, God, yeah. This is like, so I, for the longest time, I've been like, you know, I've got an iPhone, I've got two iPads, you know, one's my girlfriend's, one's mine, we've got her iPhone. And at first, I was going to take her iPhone and just put it on my plan. But by the time I was ready to do that, they had gotten rid of the unlimited plans. So we've got this household, and we're paying like $250 for data, and we use this data. I use my iPad more outside of the house than I do inside of the house. I have a little like WNYC satchel bag that my iPad is for. When I'm going out to like do something, it's going to be in there. I'm going to be using it. We use it in the car for all sorts of stuff. Its battery lasts forever, so it's really good for like GPS stuff when you're mapping in the real world. It's a great device. But you know, it's the data is 3 gigs. When I first got the iPad, when I first got this iPad, this LTE capable one, I used 3 gigs in like a day. Literally, like a day of owning it, I had used 3 gigs. And then AT&T's like, yeah, so you have to pay more money, like $30 more. And I spent a lot of – luckily, I had my MiFi, so I turned that puppy on, and I was moving at 3G for a while. But the idea is that with this setup, at every phone costs $45 a line unless you hit the 10-gig mark on the shared data. So then it drops to $30 a line. So I'm paying $60 for two telephones. Each tablet costs $10. So that's $80 right there. 10 gigabytes costs $120. So before taxes, I'm paying $200. And right now – and then like you get still 10% in there for taxes, so it's $220. So that's still $35 less than the $255 I'm paying right now on everything being separate and on its own. It also makes it so that like that $35 can go directly toward my home internet connection, which is, you know, 20 megabits, which is really reasonable for the money I pay for it. So I just feel like this is something to look at. Obviously, I'm gonna take some time, see how other people experience it before I move on. But up until now, I was thinking about like, you know, Net 10 or something. Yeah, once they get rid of these plans. So I kind of just obviously you don't want to give up your grandfathered in unlimited
right.
plan. But the unlimited plan was unlimited. Then it became 5 gigs.
Yes.
Now it's three gigs. So like, what is it really? If I can just pay
at some point, you just have to give it up, and especially as you get more and more devices, right?
Exactly, and the big thing is that I really want a world where it's just like if it costs $10 a gigabyte, then I'll pay $10 a gigabyte. Like it shouldn't be per month, shouldn't be whatever. Just like every time I use a gigabyte, charge me $10.
Right. Well, overages are $15 a gigabyte, which actually I don't think is that bad. It's actually not too bad compared to like the overage charges for cellular minutes, like
or text messages or something like
that. Exactly. Those are ridiculous.
Yeah. So I just feel like, but they're paying you, you're charging 50% more for that overage. So my whole thing is just give me a rate, guys. Let me pay as I go. If you really value that gigabyte of wireless data, if you can make margin at $10 a gigabyte, then let's give you that margin. I will use your service, all the time and everywhere. You know, and you'll get that value, that $10 a gigabyte out of me. But in this case, this is the next best thing, right? Because I think at this point, I'm not going to use all 10 gigabytes. I'm probably going to use a bunch. I'll get used to it. I'll grow into it. And when I'm ready for more, I'll be prepared for more. But we'll see also what the terms are about, like how quickly they're able to up the rates. Is $10 a gigabyte going to stay? You know, is it going to be 120 for 10 gigabytes, or are they going to pop it up to 140 one day? You know, who knows? So
let's talk about some of our headlines here. Last week, Russian developer Alexei Borodin hacked Apple's in-app purchase program for all devices running anything from iOS 3 to iOS 6, allowing iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch users to circumvent the payment process and essentially steal in-app content. Apple confirmed the workaround and said that they were investigating the issue, and ever since, they've been working hard to stop the attack, but it has yet to succeed. So first they blocked the IP address used by the Russian hacker. Next, the company issued a takedown request to the hacker's web server and contacted PayPal to prevent users from making donations to keep the service running. And last but not least, they served a copyright claim against the hacker's video that where he taught you basically how to do this this workaround. Unfortunately, all of that is not enough. The hacker switched to a server located in another country, started taking donations via Bitcoin, and he says he wants Apple to fix the problem either by changing its APIs or placing new blocks on its service. The worst part about this hack is that iOS developers have no way of protecting their apps. The iOS apps treat the server as an official communication because of how Apple authenticates a purchase. There's nothing that ties the purchase directly to a customer or device, meaning a single purchased receipt can be used again and again. In short, the hack means that in-app purchase requests are being rerouted as well as approved. So, you know,
this is the equivalent of an Apple security breach, except it's not hurting the consumer like every other person's consumer security breach. It's hurting the developer if they're focused on in-app as their model, and it's hurting Apple, who likes to take a third, like, you know, a third of that.
Sure.
So, yeah. I don't know how I feel about it. I literally don't know. On the one hand, I'm like, yay, disruption. On the other hand, I'm like, oh, those developers have, you know, they're trying to feed their families based on this in-app content.
As tempting as it is to do this, I've avoided doing it because I feel like it's in a way, even though it is hurting, you know, taking the 30% cut away from Apple, it's also hurting the little developers who rely on this on these. So there you
go. It's interesting that 9to5 Mac decided to call it disturbing. It's a disturbing development, disturbing tips. I feel like that's kind of a. It kind of just goes to it seems a little less neutral to say that they're disturbing tips. They're just tips, like, you know, this thing happened, they're covering it, that kind of thing. But I really feel like it's a bad thing. But aren't you guys thinking that after they figure out how to stop this, after they make their software update, after they force that on people and this is all fixed, they're going to be able to determine who used it? Right, like, hey, we know this in-app content you have wasn't paid for. I don't know. I just feel like there seems to be for me, what looms is that they'll know that your Apple ID was associated with this way of getting content, and there could be repercussions based on that.
Yeah, you would think so, but according to what the Russian hacker, his information, which, you know, you're trusting him now. They there is no way for you to. Because you're using someone else's receipt to authenticate the purchase requests,
right?
But who knows? I'm just morally opposed to doing it in any case. Mm. Let's move on here. Yahoo confirmed Thursday that about 400,000 usernames and passwords to Yahoo and other companies were stolen on Wednesday. A group of hackers known as the D33D, the Deed Company, posted online the user names and passwords for what appeared to be over 400,000 accounts belonging to Yahoo and also Gmail, AOL, Hotmail, Comcast, MSN, SBC Global, Verizon, Bell South, and Live.com users. They wrote a brief footnote to the data dump, which has since been taken offline. We hope that the parties responsible for managing the security of this subdomain will take this as a wake-up call and not a threat. So how beneficial, how kind of them to do this, you know, gray hat hacker deed for all of us to keep Yahoo's security in check.
Well, it's a good thing Melissa Mayer's on the case. She can handle it.
I have not checked to see whether or not one of my usernames or passwords is amongst the one.
So you it's know, totally my spam address. So
that's
cool.
Totally what's the saddest thing about this, though, is that people are like, oh, your Yahoo account was compromised. They're like, so? Whatever. Who cares? When am I ever going to use that again?
I guess unless you're on, I mean, I do have Flickr on there.
Yeah. I do too. It's.
You and I are thinking exactly like, okay, I don't want to have to deal with.
Hard to work up enough concern about this particular issue. It's like being concerned about someone taking my Dig user account.
Oh, nice.
Well, you know, we'll get into that later.
That's another issue. Yeah.
Okay, moving on here. It's been about 3 years since Microsoft unveiled a new version of Office, and particularly with Windows 8 just months away from dropping, the software has been well overdue for an upgrade. This week, Microsoft unveiled the latest edition, Office 2013, also known as Office 15, which the company will be showing in a preview stage until the final version goes on sale. Perhaps the biggest news isn't any single feature Microsoft added to Word, but how and where you'll access the files. With this version, the company is moving to a subscription-based model where your Office files are tied to your Microsoft ID. Once you sign up, you can download the various desktop apps and to a certain amount of devices, a number of devices, and as with Windows 8, your settings, SkyDrive files, and even the place where you left off in the document will follow you from device to device. So, you know, I like that idea, but I mean, that's kind of why
we
I moved.
We all knew this was coming.
Right. It's kind of why I moved away from Office and onto Google Documents. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, nothing that I used on in Office, like I don't miss any of the features that Office, the standalone Office provided that Google Docs don't have.
Right.
I don't know. If you're in a business setting.
Yeah.
Microsoft
I mean,
Excel.
That's it. If you're in a business setting, you have to get everybody else in your office using Google Docs. Mm-hmm. And even then, like, they're documents from other companies. But you know what? Ever since I started freelancing a couple of years ago, I never installed a full version of Microsoft Office, and I never really missed a beat. You know, if I need to view a PowerPoint slide or an Excel sheet or something, there are free viewers you can download online for that stuff. And Google Docs just does everything else for me.
So is this too little too late for Microsoft?
It's not my...
I don't know. I don't think it is too little too late. Because the thing is, Dwayne, you're right. People, businesses need Microsoft Office. Like, they need these formats. They need to work within these crazy programs. And, you know, schools still need it. Businesses still need it. So there's a good use for it. And I guess this is just a different way to deal with the... I don't know. Like, even though it ends up being more expensive down the line, the fact that you would have
How
to,
much
like,
is it? What is the pricing?
Let me see here. Don't have the pricing on hand, but it's if they're going with the subscription model, mm-hmm. like if you're thinking of it in that way, like that could end up being more expensive over time.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're right. I wanted to know, like, I know that if you wanted to buy the straight up super pro version of Office, I feel like that's
I don't think they announced
that's
that
like $300. That's like $300, right? If you want to buy the student version, it's usually like $125. So I wonder what they're doing to make that price point. Not their subscription price point not seem ridiculous. Like, if they want $15 a month, everyone's up Schitt's Creek. But if they want like $2-3 a month, I can see a lot of people being like, "Oh, okay, whatever." Because
I guess it depends on what you need. Yeah, $15 for unlimited access to all of the Office apps. That could be something that could be enticing. And the other good thing about that is that, you know, for the next version, you won't have to spend another $300 or $400. You know, you'll just keep the subscription going. And, you know, down the line, it may not even be that big of a difference in pricing, I guess. So they haven't announced specific pricing yet. So
especially because, like, if you think about it this way, a lot of people have Office on their computers, and a lot of people have never paid for Office on their computers. So if it is subscription, like, I mean, let's face it, like, you and I went years without paying for Office, you know? Like,
yeah, but that's because we worked at a school, and, like, we had great licensing deals. Not everybody has those great connections. And the thing is, like,
a lot of those people, they get it. They get a copy that's hacked.
Even if you pirate
whatever.
It, like pirating software these days, guys, is still pretty complicated. Like, I know people who are still trying to do that. It's dangerous. It also doesn't work very well because a lot of the encryption stuff that companies are using now just makes it really, really, really difficult. And at this point, it's just easier. The amount of effort you have to put in for that versus just settling for Google Docs or something, or just paying for Microsoft
Google
Office.
Google Docs is clearly a disruptor, which is why they want this online model. They want to be able to, you have this app on your thing if you want that functionality, but there is, like, you know, a dumbed down web version that you can get to it. All your docs are online, all that stuff. I just feel like if they can leverage the community that's been getting Office for a severe discount, by discount I mean free, for the last several years, past two decades, then they can. That extra volume can help them keep the price really reasonably, like to a reasonable level. Also, if Google Docs being what it is, if they have the price too high, people will be like, all right, I guess my life is in Google now. They just give it to Google, you know? Mm. if the price is like six, even if it's like $6 a month, so there are going to be plenty of people like, oh, okay, I guess I'll pay. But there are going to be plenty more people who are like, this Google thing isn't so bad. Google Docs is like not – remember Open Office, the Java-based sure. Office, whatever, and how painful that was?
Yes.
You know, like, Open Office clearly shows you that Microsoft's got is doing something right. But Google Docs also shows you what Microsoft's doing wrong because it's not – you get a lot of that functionality without any of that price and access to it anytime you have a connection. So Microsoft's really, I mean, everything I've seen about this product is great. Everything, all that stuff. It's just really going to come down to the pricing. If the pricing is effective, if it's competitive, people will pay that extra money for the premium of a Microsoft product. But, I mean, Google, this is, it's Microsoft's to lose if they do it the wrong way.
The pricing for Office 365 is $6 a month for a small business and $8 a month for mid-sized business and enterprises, up to $20 a month for a 5-seat license for Office Professional Plus 2010, but these are the pricings for Office 365. I'm not sure how that will translate to next
Office 15 or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. I mean, Outlook is an especially.
Well, have you guys actually taken a look at what's changed with the new Office?
It's beautiful.
It's really nice. Like, that's one thing I'm giving Microsoft some credit here for, is that this whole new flat design philosophy they're going for with mm-hmm. Metro and with Windows 8 and everything, it looks great. It is a nice, you know, a counterpoint to the old bubbly days of Windows XP and those, like, all those themes. Windows XP haunts me in my dreams, guys.
This is why I never accepted the blue bubbles, and I went with the traditional until Windows 7 came out. Because I couldn't stand the stupid green button and the blue bubbles.
Back in the day, I was a big window blinds user, and that let you customize windows in all sorts of weird ways. I really loved that. Don't need that anymore, though.
Nope.
That's good.
We've moved past that.
Yeah.
Software developers using a pre-release version of the iPhone operating system have hit a roadblock while trying to access FaceTime on AT&T cellular network. The sudden change has prompted speculation that AT&T is gearing to charge users for the data-intensive application. That's because a new notice about the restriction in the software strongly resembles a notification that emerged in another pre-release version 2 years ago. At that time, the alert appeared just before AT&T began allowing users to pay for tethering, which permits other devices to use the phone's network connection. The emergence of the potential restriction comes as AT&T is widely expected to unveil new pricing plans that will focus on data usage and diminish the role of voice minutes and text. Currently, the FaceTime app can only be used when connected to Wi-Fi, but it'll be available on all cellular networks when the new iOS is released in the fall. So, I mean, what do you think? Is AT&T going to be starting to charge for FaceTime?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like an obvious move for AT&T, especially when they're losing ground in their business model on basically this is one of the ways that they can make up what they're losing.
In SMS, especially. They're losing a lot. Apple during WWDC showed us like billions upon billions of would-be text messages that were basically aborted from the text messaging program in order to become iMessages, trickle data. You know, it's trickles of data. It's not a whole lot. And I feel like every time AT&T sees a value-added service, they say, well, your typical, normal, what we talked about with the unlimited plan, it's restricted to mm-hmm. your app access and your web access. If you want further access, you're going to have to pay a premium for that. And it's just kind of strange and weird that the word unlimited has been redefined in the 21st century to mean everything but unlimited. Like, unlimited data. No, not data if you want to tether. No, not data if you want to like use your voice phone and your face phone, your FaceTime. And the thing about FaceTime is that it's not going to take off until it becomes something you can use over cellular networks. Like, you don't go home to pull out your pad and call your other person. You want to like pull it out and see what's up, and you know what I mean. Like, I saw some commercial where mm-hmm. Apple was showing like a woman at home showing her friend the clothes she bought. You don't want to show your friend the clothes you bought. You want to show your friend the clothes that you're trying on in the store. That's mm-hmm. the big difference here.
Potentially. Yeah. I think they're going with the idea that a lot of phone calls still take place at home, And video calls, like, I'm not sure if you've been using it a lot, Dwayne, but, you know, video calls are kind of intimate, too. It's like not... Sure. It's kind of intimate on both sides, right? Because you have to allow yourself to be seen, and then you have to assume the other person at the other end doesn't mind being seen in whatever state they're in right now. So,
oh, I agree with you completely.
It's not a sort of thing like you can just spontaneously FaceTime somebody as much. I don't know. What's really sad about this is that I guess a lot of people just assumed AT&T was going to charge for FaceTime over 3G or over cellular. That's kind of a shame because it is fundamentally different than something like tethering. Mm-hmm. Right? Tethering mm-hmm. was an added service. That was the ability to like just get more data out of your phone. That made sense for them to charge more, although Verizon, I believe, doesn't charge more for that hotspot feature. But FaceTime is just like a feature that you've always had. And mm-hmm. to have
they're
to
just
pay...
try to open it up and give it more functionality. It's
exactly
more
like
severe.
I think by even putting $1 or $2 charge on FaceTime over cellular will really impede like the actual potential for that to be useful.
And that's what I mean. That's, like it's a shame. It's like I think you're right. Culturally, right now, the phone call is pretty intimate when it comes to the video phone calls. But I think if we live in a world where we're not restricted, if you can make that call ad hoc. Maybe not us, but the people just younger than us and people just younger than that, they're going to be more inclined to use that video call to share the moment at the moment as opposed to taking the video and like MMSing it. They take the video. They show the video of dude, look at this guy did this jump. Oh, it's crazy. He's just awesome on a snowboard right then and right there. Like it becomes more of a regular thing. It's a little less intimate. It's sort of like text messaging used to be something that I feel like was – It was a thing that you didn't do with a lot of people. Back in like 2003, like there were certain people you texted, and other people were like, why are you sending me a text? It's weird. But now I'm looking at
maybe it depends on your age group because a lot of people were texting.
Back in 2003, a lot less people were texting. In Europe, it was very big. But here, the demographics show. I mean, the data shows that it hadn't taken off yet. Now I have a coworker, and he like pays for his sister's cell phone 12,000 messages in a month. 12,000. When you look, he pulled up. I was asking him for the show today, and he pulled up the document. Like, you know, online, we can see when she's been texting. She texts between about 10:30 and 1 in the morning, and each text happens at about like, you know, seconds apart from the last text. So she's texting things like LOL and yeah and I love you and all this other crap like that. Not real commercial. She's basically IMing over her phone. Where IM used to be an intimate thing that you're going to talk to one of your friends that you hadn't talked to in a while and all sort of crap like that. So I feel like this stuff opens up when there are no restrictions. And I really feel like the restrictions, it's getting in the way of the innovation because there's going to be more stuff to be done with FaceTime if we don't have to think about paying for FaceTime. I guess that's all I'm saying.
I think you have a point there, but the problem is that they're going to make money any way they can, and there's no, mm-hmm. and we've said it here before on the show many times that there is no longer, this is the death of all you can eat internet.
Yeah. I think I like the term, the bandwidth belt is tightening.
Yeah, even as speeds increase. You know, what's really funny about this, and I guess what's sort of ironic, is that FaceTime over cellular won't really be useful until you're on LTE,
exactly.
Right? Like,
that's
so
true.
Until the iPhone gets LTE capable, you can't really do video chat over 3G. It's just I've tried it. You can unlock that feature if you jailbreak your phone. It's not that pretty. So whatever. You're going to be paying more for 4G LTE. By that point. So now you're going to be paying more for that service than paying more for the ability to unlock this feature that is enabled because you're paying more for that service. And it's just getting so, so weird.
The phone becomes a gas guzzler. I'm going to give you a V8 engine, but it's going to cost more gas. And here the engine is the pipe, but the pipe means you're going to be using more data. And the big thing is AT&T claims, their study shows that a 10-minute FaceTime call is like 569 megabytes. That's a lot of data for 10 minutes. I don't know where they got that number from. It doesn't seem – I feel like it – I think in a Netflix perspective, I guess. So when you don't have a great connection, the quality should lower and it shouldn't be that great. But they're claiming that a 10-minute FaceTime call over their network is 569 megabytes or whatever. That's what All Things D said. That's what Cha said in All Things D. And that's a lot of data. Like that 10-gigabyte plan I was talking about at the beginning of the show, that's like, you know, 20 calls.
Vanity Fair's Kurt Eichenwald offers an unprecedented view of life inside Microsoft during the reign of its current chief executive, Steve Ballmer, in the August issue. Eichenwald's conversation revealed that a management system known as Stack Ranking, a program that forces every unit to declare a certain percentage of employees as top performers, good performers, average, and poor, effectively crippled Microsoft's ability to innovate. Every current and former Microsoft employee I interviewed, everyone cited Stack Ranking as the most destructive process inside of Microsoft. Something that drove out untold numbers of employees. Eichenwald writes, "If you were in a team of 10 people, you walked in the first day knowing that no matter how good everyone was, 2 people were going to get a great review, 7 were going to get mediocre reviews, and 1 was going to get a terrible review." Says a former software developer, it leads to employees focusing on competing with each other rather than competing with other companies. Ed McCahill, who worked at Microsoft as a marketing manager for 16 years, says, you look at the Windows phone and you can't help but wonder, how did Microsoft squander the lead they had with the Windows CE devices? They had a great lead and they were years ahead, and they completely blew it, because of the bureaucracy. I see Microsoft as technology's answer to Sears, said Kurt Massey, a former senior marketing manager. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Sears had it nailed. It was top-notch, but now it's just a barren wasteland. And that's Microsoft. That company isn't cool anymore. They used to point their finger at IBM and laugh. Now they've become the thing they've despised. I know something has killed Microsoft's innovation. And it's interesting to hear in this article that it's this management system, this bizarre management system.
Yeah, it sounds like the use of lead goblets that took down the Roman Empire, right? Like it's this idea that
I feel like Microsoft's fallen as a culture for more than one reason, but this clearly seems like a significant reason. I mean, I don't know. Just off the cuff, before we go on, how do you guys, each of you individually, feel about Steve Ballmer?
He's a loud guy who doesn't understand technology, and that's kind of what he's always been. He's been a great cheerleader, like his famous developers thing. Right. He's a great cheerleader, but he's not a thinker, and he's not a visionary. And you know, give Bill Gates as much crap as you want, but at least he had ideas.
I also think that Steve Ballmer has a very kind of two-dimensional 50s style approach to marketing. Like he's stuck in this mindset of the way to market is to push your product further into the marketplace and not to think about how people use your products, and maybe even start with that mindset as the key to what products to develop.
Right. Yeah. He's just, I don't know, I agree. I look at this picture. The Vanity Fair shows a wonderful photograph. This, you know, this very bald man with his mouth open and an incredibly, like, severe expression with his hands in this crazy way. And that's, every time I see Steve Ballmer on film, it seems like he's a little nuts, you know? And I think that this practice is a little nuts. I know someone was sitting there and like, oh, we'll just push up the guys who are good and get rid of, like, you know, cut off the cream will rise to the top. And the bad people will go, and we'll continue to get good people. That's kind of what they were saying. They were like squeezing everything through like a funnel. But you know, the world of developers, we've seen the companies that have been acquired for the talent, the acqui-hire or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. You don't disenfranchise your talent. You don't do it. You want the best talent. You don't want them to feel as if they're going to be squeezed. That the one guy who's 1% less than the other guys is going to be given the poor review. And it's clearly like this is a symptom of bad management, you know?
Right.
It's a symptom of the problem. I feel like it's like inflammation. Inflammation is both a symptom and a cause of problems, right?
Right.
You get inflammation in your shit, it's going to hurt. That's one of the symptoms. There's also fucking up all your other shit. So
you're calling Microsoft a major hemorrhoid?
Is that
Microsoft's got some roids.
It's got some roids. It's got some arthritis. It needs to work out more. And by working out, I mean it needs to focus more on the emerging technology, pushing the envelope. Yeah. This
I
office thing, we said, is
brilliant. I think now right?
In some ways they are, yeah.
Yeah, with Windows 8, with Windows Phone, even though like that whole turnaround, like I'm not sure, did we talk about this very much, but the swap to the kernel for the Windows 8 kernel, which, you know...
We mentioned a little bit how Windows 8 makes all the Windows 7 devices obsolete.
That whole swap is kind of crazy, but what they're doing with Windows Phone is kind of interesting, at least. It's an interesting design difference from Android and iPhone. Like, they're trying, but... Yeah, this article points out a lot of things we've always been hearing, is that Microsoft is a very management, or I guess good ideas die in management. And I guess the best example of this is looking at, like, The Courier, which we've talked about a lot. CNET had a great story on that. Like, The Courier was
Firefly technology.
Yeah, exactly. They were pushing it, and then... It seemed pretty clear that Windows 8 tablets, that was going to be the future for Microsoft, and they didn't want anything distracting from that. And that basically is what happened to The Courier. It died off because, you know, they wanted to push Windows and tablets, and I guess that makes a certain amount of sense. Although, you know what? Honestly, now, the Courier could easily run, like, a version of Windows 8 or something, like Windows RT. There's no reason why it couldn't. But Microsoft, being the dinosaur that it is, can't quite think that way,
right?
So they just killed that one product. Meanwhile, you have something like the Kin that actually gets released, even though nobody wants it. Nobody wants it. Maybe people want it, maybe teens wanted it in like 1999, but by the time nobody wants it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, here's what we see. Andy hit the nail on the head. They are pushing products that they believe will be awesome, but they don't have anything telling, like, there's nothing telling them that. Like, I'm not saying they need focus groups, but they do need some sort of data. Like, at least with Apple, their whole mantra is, we're going to build products that we want to use. They didn't want to use the Kin. They never – like, no one at Microsoft was like, yeah, I'm going to use the Kin over my Windows phone.
But Apple doesn't use focus groups. That's the other thing, too.
Yeah, they don't use focus groups because they have designers
at the high end. Like, the people who rule Apple aren't the engineers or the managers. It's the designers. And
it's the designers, and Apple is – yeah, exactly. And they're focused on using products that they want – making products that they want to use themselves, whereas I feel like Microsoft is like, they have an idea – in their head somehow, some way, of what they should make, and they haven't even checked the marketplace to see what's up there, which is why they're so far behind on touchscreen devices, which is why they're everything, all this, like, we talk about Nokia having its last throws. Like, Microsoft needs to get this Surface correct. They need to get these tablets correct. If they don't, they're done. I'll put it out there.
Are they done? Are they? That's the problem, right? Microsoft is so big. They can survive.
It's a slow death. It's a slow death. Like, what's happening with the Earth and the stupid.
I think there is something that Devinder said, though, for sure.
No, but, like,
I mean,
the Greenland, what's it called? The Greenland iceberg that just like broke apart. Like, yeah, it's a slow death, but we all see it.
They may be too big to fail.
No such thing.
Exactly. However, I mean, you look at like the rampant success of Office and Windows at this point, like they're going to continue making money for a very long time. The problem is that made them lazy. You know,
so
that
Nokia though. Nokia is still like, it was the biggest phone maker in the world. They've been around for 130 years. Nokia isn't the oldest tech company that ever existed. Really.
That's a little different though. I understand the comparison.
Seriously, it's a long fall. Yeah. Is all I'm saying.
I will say that what we may see is what happened to IBM, where they go from being a company that sells hardware to a company that sells services.
Right.
So I can certainly see that happening to Microsoft.
But now they're at least trying to actually expand out by saying, we're going to create some of our own hardware. It's at least reference hardware.
Yeah. They're going from software to hardware, and that's a key.
The Xbox is
a key jump.
Yeah.
I don't think Google will ever survive in hardware, but I think Microsoft could because they know
enough. They bought Portable Mobility. I think they bought that, and I think the Nexus 7 is made by Asus. I'm not sure. I think the Galaxy Nexus, is that made by Samsung?
Yeah.
Right. I think as long as they...
You know what was made by Google? The Nexus Q, guys. Made in America.
Yeah. I just think that if Google focuses on continuing to pump out those products by the actual manufacturers that have that Nexus name, they'll be okay until they can get Motorola off the ground. Microsoft, it's unclear who's making their stuff. It's unclear how great it works. Again, the Surface, you can't...
Well, Microsoft is making their stuff. They designed it. They're working directly with manufacturers. It's not like they're just outsourcing it.
Sure. I just feel like the Surface, it's the tablet that's all about touch that no one ever touched. It's interesting to see. Like, the Xbox, phenomenal, but we all know the Xbox, as much as it could have been the future of Microsoft, is kind of on an evolutionary branch of its own, right?
You think so? Because the whole, like, if you think of the War of the Living Room, right? The War of the Living Room, which Apple has ignored, a lot of companies don't quite know what to do. Microsoft has been there for the past decade, slowly
We'll only see, like, with this new OS,
right,
we will see how that integrates across things. Because, yes, right, Apple has ignored the living room, but the fact is, my work to home experience is better through the way Apple integrates its products than it is through the way Microsoft integrates its products. It's still difficult. It's not like super intuitive for me to pop on my Xbox and play a movie off my computer on it. You know, like, I have to make sure that file is sitting in a certain folder.
Well,
you're
thinking, I think, in terms of the past way of doing things, right? You're thinking of, playing a file from your computer. I mean, the future is we're not dealing with files anymore. We're dealing with, like, you know, streaming services.
That's why I'm saying the new OS is a big deal, because
currently
with Microsoft, if I use my Microsoft-enabled, my Microsoft, like, platform laptop and my Microsoft platform living room device, and I want to have, like, you know, I want to show, I want to mirror one screen onto the other, or I want to show content from one device onto the other, it's a lot of work. With Apple, it's not a lot of work. It goes for showing spreadsheets on my iPad or playing a movie off my iPad or off my my laptop or whatever. So Microsoft, with the new OS and the integration they want to have across all those devices, I really feel like this is the make or break. This Windows Phone 8, this, you know, Windows 8, this stuff, whatever update they do to the software, the Xbox, this is really where they have to watch out. Because if Apple adds apps to that Apple TV and still sells it for $100, they're going to be in trouble. And we've seen, you know, the Google thing that we were talking about earlier, that's an Android-focused platform. You know, it can talk to all your other Android devices. If it can talk to all your stuff, that's really what people care about. That's all I'm saying.
All right, let's take a little break here. We're going to take a little break. But before we do, before we get into our main topic, we're going to talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And I chose something light this week to talk about, which is a book called What Einstein Told His Cook, Kitchen Science Explained. I don't know if Einstein actually is involved in this inside this book whatsoever, but it's basically kitchen science from, like, a Alton Brown perspective, where they talk about the chemistry of kitchen science and how it helps how it helps you to understand why things are the way they are. Why is red meat red? How do they decaffeinate coffee? And so on. It's University of Pittsburgh chemistry professor emeritus and award-winning Washington Post food columnist Robert L. Wolk provides reliable and witty explanations for your most burning food questions while debunking misconceptions and helping you interpret confusing advertising and labeling. Finalist for both the James Beard Foundation and IACP Awards for Best Food Reference, What Einstein Told His Cook engages cooks and chemists alike. So that book, amongst any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook, along with a 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And that going to that site helps our show out. So if you've never tried Audible before, please use that code to try us out and try them out and help our show out. Okay, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the downfall of Digg, probably one of the premier social news sites of its time, of its era, and now it's been sold for $500,000. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Raising in the grass.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar and Duane DeFreitas, and let's talk about Dig. So Dig was at one time one of the a social media pioneer once valued at more than $160 million. I remember the famous Business Week cover with the founder Kevin Rose on the cover that called him the $60 million kid, or how this kid made $60 million, or is worth $60 million.
Right, right.
Dig has sold for the deeply discounted price of about $500,000. People familiar with the matter have said. Although, realistically, TechCrunch has said that if you break down the value of what they've sold in the past, the Washington Post paid about $12 million for Dig's like tech team, and right. around the same time, LinkedIn paid about $4 million for about 15 different Dig patents.
Yeah,
and then BetaWorks picked up the remaining assets for between $500,000 and $725,000, according
which
to
which kind of shows how, and so that's basically like the Dig infrastructure and technology. It kind of shows you how little, I guess, there was going on there, right? To be valued at basically nothing. Yeah.
In the 80s, we would have said that it was a takeover, and that Dig was broken up and sold into pieces. Right, like that's what mm-hmm. it was. All these are just pieces of a company. It's just right. that the brand name has stayed with this $500,000 piece that's left over.
Right.
So it's
this
interesting.
Is like the last of Dig.
Exactly, yeah. The last vestige.
And it's unclear what BetaWorks plans to do with it. I mean,
they're saying a cloud version of Dig or something. It's going to be integrated in their NewsMe service, which it's all right. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of one of those things that's what Dig could have been if they kept iterating on it. So yeah, I don't. It could be something really interesting, but don't expect like the resurgence of Dig at any point.
No. I mean, it's kind of sad because everybody saw it coming. And I think that I was probably one of the first people to see it coming because Dig had showed. I think the downfall of Dig could be there's a clear demarcation when that happened. And that's when they launched their version 4 of the site, in which the version 4 traded individual content curation for. Basically giving publishers free rein to hook their RSS feeds up to Dig's submission engine and letting them submit basically anything that came out of their sites. And Dig previewed this to me in a beta test round. And when I saw this, when I saw the beta test of what would be version 4, like my jaw dropped. And I told them outright, if you do this, people are going to flee the site like rats leaving a sinking ship. And that's exactly what happened. And then by that point, it was too late for them to turn the ship around, to put the plug back in the sinking ship.
So you're saying if they had just gone to you with the concept for Dig 4, this whole thing, Reddit might still be fighting. The war, the end comment war might still be going on. So
there
you single-handedly
another issue going on too, right?
Andy single-handedly destroyed all of Dig. That's how I'm reading it.
Well, it's like what the philosopher king syndrome, right? Like you have these couple people who are in charge, and I know that was great. Like it was great to be one of those people. I, in my little tiny little blog on GoDaddy.com, I occasionally saw the benefit of that when people dug my stories. I used to get like 50,000 to 60,000 hits per story, and my little blog would fall apart with that sort of thing. So there was that. I think what's interesting, the difference is that Reddit kind of counteracted that from the beginning, and also Reddit's audience is just very, very different. It's almost as if they won't allow any one person to be that sort of like heavy user, even though they do exist.
It's true.
They don't have as much control for
right,
one thing.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a couple of interesting pieces that have been written about Dig's downfall. Om Malik wrote one on GigaOm that said, essentially, I'm going to quote here from it. If the yardstick of success is making money for the founders, employees, and investors, then Dig will go down in the annals of web history as a colossal failure. However, if your yardstick of success is defined by a company or product being a change agent and instigator, then Dig was a smashing success. It is maybe a failed new media company, but is also a pioneer that changed the media landscape, not by creating anything, but instead by putting the people in charge of what was media. Like Flickr, it was a company that opened our eyes to the potential of the social web, also reminded us that links are and will always be the atomic unit of the web. Whether media doyens want to admit it or not, Dig changed how a lot of media was created and shared. Top 10 lists were popular on Dig and generated a lot of traffic, so even the most established media companies embraced that. Headlines were crafted to get the highest amount of attention and votes on Dig. Dig is gone, but it will always remain with us in its defeat. It turned out to be a victor. I don't know. What do you think about that? I think, in one hand, mm-hmm. I appreciate there's no denying the influence that Dig had on social, basically social networking in general.
Right.
I don't know that I would call it a smashing success, because I think that part of the failure was that they actually turned their back on putting people in charge of what was media.
Sure. They forgot about what made them kind of popular, and they didn't really ever double down on that initial mm-hmm. idea, right? Yeah, the initial idea was giving people control of the news. And I think they kind of just lost their way. And actually now them declining that buyout mm-hmm. is looking dumber and dumber all the time. One thing I'm noticing, though, is that a lot of these early Web 2.0 companies, you count some news sites in these, too. Like, a lot of them, they definitely helped instigate a whole new sense of, like, what the web can be, what media can be. They helped to define social media and the whole Web 2.0 wave. But, a lot of them that haven't been able to actually evolve to mm-hmm. look beyond the whole new Web 2.0 era mm-hmm. or the social media era, they're kind of just dying. Like, that's the thing. Like, I feel like that whole wave is dying off now.
Yeah.
And the time to really either evolve or just hopefully get bought out is just way gone. And this whole Dig purchase shows that for sure.
I agree. And in fact, I think that this is kind of a contentious statement. I don't mm-hmm. know if you'll agree with it or not, but I think that even Reddit is kind of a dinosaur. as popular as it is, and especially as popular as it has been in the wake of Dig's downfall,
right,
the
right.
Reddit model of voting stories up, which is all the Dig model and the Slashdot model, is kind of a dinosaur. And I think the new wave of mm-hmm. of social aggregation in sites like Facebook and Twitter and even Pinterest and Tumblr, that's the new wave. And I think Reddit may not. I think there's probably going to be a limit to the success that Reddit achieves using this old model.
Sure. I guess the difference, though, is that Reddit, or at least the Reddit creators and the people running the site, have always been super focused on the community.
Yes.
And they've always,
yes.
Taken the community's best interests mm-hmm. at heart for everything Reddit's done. So that's why it really hasn't changed that much. But, you look at Craigslist, too. Like, Craigslist has not changed at all, because right. they're not even trying to be a business. Craigslist is just trying to be this social service that mm-hmm. people can use online. And I guess in a similar way, Reddit has ended up being that social service for news. But you know what? It's still successful at driving a ton of page views.
Sure.
So, they haven't changed much. But I don't know. For whatever you would call success for a news site, they're still doing pretty well.
I want to quote this M.G. Siegler article. And normally I would not quote M.G. Siegler, but I have to give him his props, because he was, in fact, an early Dig power user. So he has a lot of expertise in what he's talking about. And he just kind of gives a very concise, accurate overview of what it was like to to control the front page in those days. He says here, it seems silly now, but remember that when Dig enabled was very unique at the time. The number of eyeballs that the front page of Dig could direct towards a story was massive. This was power, and the ability to submit stories as well as vote on them gave part of this power to the users. Unsurprisingly, this power gave rise to power users. While Dig may have started out with the idea that anyone could submit any content and have it reach the front page, things quickly veered towards the 90-10 rule as Dig grew in popularity. That is, the idea that 10% of the users were the ones creating the content, while the other 90% were the ones consuming it. There were several studies in the heyday of Dig about just how few people controlled what appeared on the front page. It was basically just a few dozen. Again, the power users. I was one of them. I'm quoting MG. Back in the day, Dig had a leaderboard to highlight these users. It was based on a number of front page stories that users submitted, but it also showed things like ratio of total stories submitted to those that have become popular. At my peak, says MG, I believed I was in the top 25 of that list with a popular ratio of well over 50%. In some ways, Dig was a game, and I love games. He says, but I don't mean to minimize the importance of Dig. While a gaming element drove some of the use, at the end of the day, all that mattered were the digs themselves, as in the votes. Sure, people would dig each other's stories in order to get votes back, but if the story was bullshit, it either wouldn't make the front homepage or wouldn't last long there. Behold the power of the berry. Good content was always paramount to Dig, and that's why it worked as a service, not just for the power users, but for everyone. I spent a lot of time scouring the web looking for good content to submit. I used to get asked a lot back then why I would spend so much time on Dig when the benefits weren't immediately apparent. My answers at the time ranged from lazy, boredom, to righteous. I was helping people find good content, but in hindsight, the answer is far better. Without Dig, I almost certainly would not be where I am now. That reads like hyperbole, but it's not. And that is, I think, I truly believe that is true about MG Siegler, or Paris Lemon, as I used to know him on Dig. And I would say that my experience was very similar to this, as far as, you know, people would often accuse me of using reciprocal voting to get my stories on the front page, and that was the only reason that they would get on the front page. But I think he's right in the fact that regardless of whether I was using any sort of reciprocal voting or not, they wouldn't stay on the front page if there were bullshit stories, and I think that was the one mm-hmm. of the strengths of Dig.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting too is how Dig has helped a lot of people propel themselves yeah. onto the web too. Like MG's story, I actually remember reading like MG when he started at VentureBeat and mm-hmm. then his whole move to TechCrunch and everything. But yeah, that his entire career kind of was made because of Dig. And yeah. you know, and a lot of people, right. it's important to a lot of people, even if it didn't end up being a smashing success financially.
I mean, I like what you read before. I really think that Dig changed the game. In terms of the long-lasting American legacy company, it's not that. It's Woolworths. It changed how things are done, but now it's gone. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Like, it made its impact, and now it's kind of, you know, just kind of fallen off the radar. Right. We haven't talked about Kevin Rose at all, which is surprising. Didn't you guys have Kevin Rose on the show?
We did. We
way
did.
Back when?
Yeah.
What's going to happen to the business?
I mean, this show, Andy,
cover?
This show was created because of Dig.
Yeah.
And named after that whole idea, drilling down, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the realistically, I've always tried to avoid the direct connection to Dig because I wanted it to stand alone as its own tech podcast. But I'll admit that I think a good boost of the popularity, the initial popularity of the show mm-hmm. is because people were following me from Dig.
Yeah.
So I certainly can't deny that. And it's interesting, like, I think Kevin Rose may have ended up the best out of all of this in mm-hmm. that he, through his association with Dig, through creating it, he was and if you think about this, he's not really he's not like an engineer, you know?
Right.
He doesn't have
he's an idea guy.
Right, he's an idea guy.
Like kind of like Steve Jobs.
Right.
Or he wishes, you know.
But yeah. to parlay that success on Dig into.
Yeah, ideas are one thing. We all have them, but it's the execution that's imperative.
Hey, he executed. He didn't follow through. He can. Yeah, I mean, he doesn't follow. That's the clear difference.
It was there. It was doing what it had to do. He just wasn't able to take his vision to the next level. He should have brought people in.
But to parlay that into like being able to having the opportunity to get into VC funding, mm-hmm. and then also and then later on, exchanging that for a job at Google.
Yeah. I mean, it's overall like you could say he's basically been failing upwards for a while, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, because Dig kind of. When he got bored with that, like it looks like we saw stuff happening at Milk.
Right.
When Twitter was first starting, there was Pounce, right? And that was the other Kevin Rose joint, which kind of didn't go anywhere. Milk didn't go anywhere.
Right. He should have just Google gone Ventures, with, like, he should have gone with, like, Yahoo. Like, he should have gone at you. When he was worth $160 million, he should have sold his shit to Yahoo.
I'm sure they would have wanted to sell for anybody at this point, like, at least $100
million. At 160, at 160, he should have been like, did he know where it was going?
I don't know.
I think they held out. I think
they thought they were a lot more valuable than they were. It's just you know what, guys? I do remember seeing Kevin Rose like as the like geeky little intern on the screensavers on Tech TV, and I used to watch this kid in high school. So it's kind of funny how like just seeing how like my life has as my life has gone on, seeing where Kevin Rose has gone, seeing where all those Tech TV people have ended up. They're all in their own like little specialty places online now.
They're like a boy band.
It is. It's sort of like a special band. I don't know, a misfit group of tech nerds. Do you guys know the story of like how he created Dig and like the lengths he went to do that?
I do, but yeah, I mean, go ahead and tell us.
I mean, it's something worth considering, right? I mean, we could sit here and rag on the fact that, you know, Dig may not have ended up being what he wanted, or it may not have ended up being a smashing success for its investors. But, you know, this is the guy had a dream. Like, he had a dream. He had a vision. He had a lot of money saved up that I believe that was going to go for his first house with his girlfriend at the time. And I think, I'm not going to get too soap opera here, but I think that was Sarah Lane, who was on Tech TV with him.
Right.
Sarah Lane, by the way, who is now dating MG Siegler.
Right.
This is all getting really Days of Our Lives now. So
very incestuous.
I think they broke up because he pursued Dig and he used his life savings to kind of make Dig a reality. So I respect the guy for following through and doing that, because that's more than a lot of these, I don't know, mouth breathers online are ever going to do. Yeah.
That's some shit.
Well, there you go.
I just wanted to point that out there. I do think he's still been failing upwards, but I give him credit for going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's got $500,000 more dollars than a lot of people do. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe not. It's not even him. Yeah, no. Because I think he actually took some cash on the table early on.
That was a little controversial. There was like a funding round, and he had taken some of the cash. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see what he does next on with Google, but I have to say that I haven't been too blown away from what he has done since Dig, unfortunately.
Well, you know, Google and Google Ventures may actually be a good fit for him, right? Because they're all a bunch of pipe dreamers, really. I don't think Google Ventures is really funded or helped promote anything that's been wildly successful yet. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think maybe at least they'll appreciate his perspective in things.
Right.
Every rose has its thorn.
All right. We're going to take another little break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about one of the most interesting occupational changes here in the last week. Marissa Mayer going from Google to Yahoo.
Yahoo.
Yeah. So let's take a little listen to some music, and we'll return after this break.
After all you put me through, you think I despise you. But in the end, I want to thank you, because you made me that much stronger.
Lost much smarter. Thanks for making me a fighter.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersei. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar and Duane DeFreitas. And this week, Marissa Meyer, Meyer, one of the top executives at Google, announced her resignation from Google to become the next chief of Yahoo, making her one of the most prominent women in Silicon Valley and corporate America. The appointment of Ms. Meyer is considered a coup for Yahoo, which has struggled in recent years to attract top talent in its battle with competitors. One of the few public faces of Google, she's been responsible for the look and feel of some of the search company's most popular products. And despite her background, she will be the Yahoo's fifth chief executive in less than a year, two of them interim. She faces a daunting challenge. As Google and Facebook have emerged as web giants, Yahoo has struggled to create a distinct strategy, even though the audience remains among the largest on the internet. Now the company is moving to lay off thousands of employees in the face of slumping profits and a lackluster stock. The big question is whether Ms. Meyer or anyone can help Yahoo regain its former stature. That is a good question.
It is a good question. I mean, people put Yahoo there next to Google and Facebook, but let's remember, Yahoo isn't a Google and Facebook. Yahoo is like, it's some class of, it's like it's graduating class involved like Lycos and Excite and Alta Vista and these places you just haven't heard from in years and years and years. I wouldn't call it a dinosaur because it's not extinct yet, but it is the most adaptive.
Well, dinosaurs aren't extinct. Dinosaurs are old and they don't belong in this time zone anymore.
Right.
And like, I think in that respect, Yahoo's definitely a dinosaur.
Yahoo, yeah. But I feel like when I see dinosaur, I feel like something that's really just out of its depth. I think Yahoo is on the brink of becoming that living fossil. You know that fish, that old school fish at the bottom of the sea? That's like, or like the rhinoceros, right? It's a mammal, but it's clearly like remnant of an old period. And if it doesn't adapt, it adapted. It adapted and it's still alive. And sure, it's rare. But I feel like when I think of Google and Facebook, they're more akin. Google 2000, Facebook 2003, 2004. Whereas Yahoo, I was in high school. And the commercials, you know, we just talk about high school. I was in high school and the commercials were there talking about, you know, are you on Yahoo? Are you doing Yahoo? A big piece of this is understanding what Yahoo is. Yahoo has not really been a search company, even though search has always been their thing.
Well, Yahoo doesn't know what it is, though.
Yeah, that's a problem. But yeah. Yahoo has focused. I mean, their focus has never really been search. It's always been this portal, and it's always been trying to define itself. That's how it's been able to move year after year, time after time, place after place, and remain itself. Yeah. Marissa Meyer. I mean, we've read the stories. The VentureBeat story. The real reason she had to leave Google is because she had to, because she didn't. The power that she sees, like Vikram Gotra and some other guys and Lara's getting, it wasn't there for her. There was no room for her there. She's already worth $300 million.
Yeah, no object at this point.
Right, she doesn't have to work anymore. She's worth $300 million. She doesn't have to work. But she wants to do something with her life. And if she can pull off turning Yahoo around, making Yahoo relevant for the next 10 years, that's going to be the sort of thing that Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman are totally, you know, I mean, Meg Whitman, brilliant as she is, but Carly Fiorina, she's like that name won't mean anything because Meyer will have like redefined
the woman.
It still
doesn't mean anything.
For a lot of people, it does, especially for like people on the conservative side of like technology business. But I feel like, and then there's the whole thing with the pregnancy. And, you know,
completely badass.
Days of Our Lives, come on. Like, it's so badass because. This is, I mean, 20 years ago, I read the other day that this, you know, this gentleman, he was writing, like, we probably won't see a pregnant CEO in our lifetime. 20 years later, it took tech to bring that to us. It took technology in Silicon Valley to bring a Fortune 500 company CEO in the limelight, in the profile, the true power couple, the woman who's, like, been on the cover of magazines because of her fashion sense and still, like, you know, takes home like all the money herself, decides that she wants to have a baby, but not only does she wants to have it, she also wants to nurture this failing, you know, tech giant. Right. So
I mean, it is badass beyond badass. She's like she's like Ripley in that suit fighting the alien queen. That's what I'm seeing here.
And by the way, I'm pregnant. What I love is that this is like the fear that a lot of the men in like boardrooms and men in business who are like who think women can't be high level executives. Like at some point they're going to get pregnant, and then how are they going to do their job? You know what? I have a feeling Marissa Mayer is still going to be able to do her job, have this baby, and turn Yahoo around, and then say, you know what, guys, this is how you do it. I think the really interesting thing too is that even if she doesn't succeed, she'll kind of get a pass, because then it'll be like, oh, well, you know, guys, Yahoo was so screwed.
Right.
Nope. Yeah,
right.
Was screwed.
Well, you know,
she wins either way. Come on.
That's kind
of. It's not just women. It's not just men, though, because I was sitting in my office. I was talking about Marissa Mayer, and a guy and a girl. You know, two people who work together on this team. Girl's the senior director at my company, so she's no small thing. And she's like, how's she going to do that if she's pregnant? And I was like, really? like, and they went into, like, how people get moody and all sorts
of
stuff.
I think that's
like,
so a non-issue in this
case.
Well,
it's funny.
I mean, it's tough. It's going to be a tough thing.
Easy,
but people deal with all sorts of tough things when they're
and she's thought
dealing
about
with their jobs.
Clearly, you have $300 million and you're, like, a super tight VP at Google and you get this job. And you get pregnant. She didn't just get pregnant. She didn't get pregnant. She didn't take a pee test and then say, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. She knew she was pregnant, right? Like, this is the getting the Yahoo job is not a it's a thing that takes, there's a long runway there. And announcing your pregnancy is also something that you don't just do the minute the pee test says yes. So she knew what was happening. She was smart enough not to say anything about it until she got the job, it seems, because today in our world, that's still like, oh, I don't know if she could do it. But I really think I really think that a lot of people are like, oh, but how can she do it? I just remember being a teenager and thinking, oh my God, PMS, how do people do it? I'm in the office every day. I never think about PMS. I never think about a woman being like, oh, I can't do something because I might menstruate in a couple days. Like, people have control over themselves and their bodies. People know what they need to do and they know their capabilities. And she's proven that her capabilities far outstrip.
I think the bigger issue is, how is she going to turn Yahoo around? I mean, just basically, it's a basic question.
It's the basic question. And I think the thing is that Yahoo hasn't had in a while. You know, Dwayne, we were trying to determine what, like, prehistoric creature Yahoo actually is. I think it's more like the Loch Ness Monster, right? It's like a thing that we think it exists. We've heard that there's something there, and maybe occasionally it'll pop its head out. I think, like, the company there, it has a lot of good properties, and all it needs is a bit of focus. Like, it needs one person to say, okay, we're going to be doing this. We're going to kill all the extra companies that don't really need to be around. They're already sunsetting a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
So they're already losing a bunch of that crap. And there's still things they can do. They have a ton of money. They can still re-energize themselves. They're still looking at things like, in terms of mobile, in terms of social companies and social uses, there's still a lot of use there for Yahoo. So I've seen some commentary that potentially Foursquare would be a good fit for them to buy at some point. And that sort of thing makes sense to me. Like, get a nice young company, and Foursquare, by the way, is struggling right now because they still can't quite make a business of that whole thing. They're kind of diminishing check-ins at this point, and they're trying to push this whole thing about just following what your friends are doing. You know, for something like Foursquare would be actually a great fit for Yahoo. Any young company that needs, you know, that would fit into this greater vision, I think, of what Yahoo
and that
could.
has a leader like Marissa Mayer to understand
exactly
how to integrate it and how to make use for it and not get wrapped up in, like, you know, the ads, right? Like, I remember reading that she almost got rid of ads in Gmail. Let's face it, ads in Gmail, you know, that would not have been a bad thing. We would all still be using Gmail. It wouldn't stop the fact that we're using Gmail. In fact, they might have added more adoption to it because she was like, you know, like, the product is good enough to bring people into Google without the ad stuff. You know what I mean? So I feel like she's not focused on that short-term gain. She's, like, looking at for the playing the long game, and that's what Yahoo needs. It needs to look at the technologies that it has, look at the right ones to acquire, and see how to integrate them and turn them into an experience that people really, really want. And, you know, like, you go to the yahoo.com page and there's a lot of gossip, and then there's this thing called Yahoo Sites on the side. It's a million different things.
Yeah,
they're all
yeah.
separate that you never associate with Yahoo. Like, making that,
I think,
you know,
the Yahoo's big problem is the same problem that is when you when you are there's a saying, when you're telling a story, you have to know who your audience is. And I think that's Yahoo's problem too, is they're telling all of these different stories and they don't know who their specific audience is. And I almost feel like the way to solve Yahoo is to strip it down to absolutely nothing and then start over again, building from the focus that you want to
you're saying Yahoo needs a diet to get rid of all the fat.
They
need to rebuild with muscle. It's like,
like a liposuction.
Yeah.
It's like they just need to suck it all out fat, and then they need to build it back with muscle.
They need
really
to be stripped down to the skeleton and then add the muscle on, you know, from there, and then just focus on exactly what story you want to tell with Yahoo. Because I have no idea what Yahoo is. I know what Google is. I know what Microsoft is. I know what Apple is. But I have no idea what Yahoo is trying to be.
It's nuts. That's what Yahoo means.
And that's the key. I think that's the key. And if Marissa Mayer can tell that story, if she can focus on what Yahoo is and tell that story, more power to her. I mean, I want to read a little bit from this article about Business Insider posted a story about her two contrasting reputations. And they say that there are two views of former Google VP and new Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer in the industry. One is that she's a brand name product leader who played a crucial role in helping Google develop its most valuable business search, and then went on to guide the development of several other popular products, including Gmail, Google Maps, and Google News. This view's popularity is the reason Yahoo's board is thrilled to have her as its CEO. The board believes it'll help her recruit talent in the company. It probably will. The other view, more common amongst longtime Googlers, is that Mayer is a publicity-craving, lucky early Googler whose public persona outstripped her actual authority and power at the company, where she was once a rising star, thanks to a bullying managerial style, but had become marginalized over the past couple years. Former Google executives who've worked with Mayer say, "This is a great day for Google and a nail in the coffin for Yahoo." So they say that she was a nightmare to work with, someone who had her own publicist, forced underlings to sign customized NDAs, and maintained a shadow HR staff and a shadow recruiting staff just for her team.
She needs to be a CEO. She can't be just another VP. She's running a division like it's its own company. So a place where she can go and have that carte blanche to like do what she needs to do for a few years to see if she can turn it around or whatever. That to me sounds like her behavior. To me sounds like a woman who needed to get more done.
Maybe Yahoo was allowed.
Her authority
kind
was
of
not
tough love.
Was not able to get her where she wanted to go.
Yeah, maybe they need that kind of tough love at Yahoo.
Oh, maybe they need a spanking, and if she's going to give it to them, you know, she is a mom now.
It may not be a terrible thing. All of these negative stories that we're hearing of her time at Google may not be a terrible thing for Yahoo.
You know, one thing I think Yahoo could be very good at is snapping up and kind of incubating a lot of great mobile apps and mobile services, because just in terms of companies I'm seeing now and startups that I'm seeing, not to be too, too partial to my own beat, but everything happening in mobile is so exciting now. And that's something that Microsoft and Google, like Google has Android, but they're not as exactly focusing on specific apps and things that other people, like things outside of Android. That's a space for Yahoo.
That's
going to really
require
make
a lot
a difference.
Of...
Especially on Android, because I feel like, you know, Apple's got iOS, and like it used to be that they had a couple basic apps: phone, calendar, mail, Safari. But now every year there's like a couple new apps. There's the Wi-Fi administrative app for your airport, whatever. There's the podcast app, which is different from the music app, which is different from the videos app. Every year they're building more and more things, and those things don't exist natively on Android. You know, like there's room for a company that has the kind of content that Yahoo has to build those engagements, to get that engagement on a platform that doesn't have those default pieces yet. Google Play is great, but it's kind of, I don't know where I am when I'm on it. Whereas Yahoo can say, I've got great content, and I can create the apps to get to it, best. So I think there's something there.
I will say that I am surprised, pleasantly surprised, sometimes with Google's, I'm sorry, with Yahoo's content. Like today, I was stumbling around on Yahoo and I discovered a 10-part animated series created by Tom Hanks that's exclusively on Yahoo, and I'm like, what? How did this? I'd never even heard of this.
And it's like badass looking. Like it looks like it's a Electric City. It's like like a like one of those Warner Brothers DC comics like you know movies. It's like serious. Right.
But I mean Yahoo. I mean we should be. Yahoo could do better at letting people know basically what their strengths are.
That's what I'm saying. A Yahoo Videos app, right. You know, like a Yahoo Music app, like you know,
they have a lot of clout with movies too. Studios for some reason left to debut their trailers on Yahoo Movies. Who goes to Yahoo Movies? I don't know.
I only go there to see the trailers that they're
debuting. Exactly. Yeah.
I only go to Yahoo Movies. This is weird Apple Movies thing. I don't know why anyone watches a trailer like that.
Anyway, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Devendra. Where can we find you when you're not here on The Drill Down?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I chat about movies and TV at /film.com. And I write about technology at venturebeat.com.
Awesome.
The podcast Cora.
Cora's over, but I have been doing a Republic's Legend of Cora podcast at republiccitydispatch.com. The first season is over, but we may follow up with episode commentary and some interviews. So we'll see how that
what
goes.
What other podcasts are you doing outside of, cuz you said you're starting to get into a lot more podcasts?
I'm always guesting on other people's shows, so that's just how it's going. And there are some new projects coming up, too, that I can't talk about yet. They could be cool.
Nice. Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can you find you online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter.com at twitter.com/DwayneD. And in the next couple of days, you should be able to find me on the Intermundo Media blog. That's a blog at intermundomedia.com.
Oh. as for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan. You can always check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. You can see my full Comic-Con coverage at geeksofdoom.com as well. Subscribe to us on iTunes at Geeks of Doom. Geeksofdoom.com. Go to the right hand sidebar. We're up at the top, and you can find our subscription links there. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices with Stitcher. Smart radio for your phone. You can find it at in your app store at Stitcher.com. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown. Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when we go live. And I noticed this week there were like a good small handful of extra subscribers there. So it's
nice.
We're getting the word out for that. If you have an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. A viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.